Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. McAllen, Texas has some of the priciest health care in the country. Per capita income, $12,000. Per capita health care costs via Medicare, $15,000. Twice the national average, but not twice the good health. Surgeon journalist Atul Gawande went down to McAllen to see what was going on. He found doctors working the system and a case study in the kind of health care no country can afford. This hour on Point, on the road to health care reform, lessons for the nation from one Texas town. You can join the conversation. What is it going to take to rein in runaway health care costs in this country? Tell us what you hear in this tale out of Texas. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is surgeon and writer Atul Gawande. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, where his article, The Cost Conundrum, What a Texas Town Can Teach Us About Healthcare, appeared in the June 1st issue. He is also a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and on the staff of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and a professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School. He's written brilliantly for years on healthcare and a life in medicine. His most recent book is Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. This time out, he is surgeon as investigative journalist. Atul Gawande, Dr. Gawande, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Wow. So you're making waves with this piece. Atul, we had President Obama just yesterday talking with Senate Democrats in charge of pushing health care legislation. That is coming very soon in Washington, and he's practically quoting right out of your article here. This has really made a splash. Here's a town on the Mexican border where people don't make a lot of money, where you say their health is not, the underlying health is not worse. In some ways, it may be better than in other towns, and yet they spend nearly twice the national average. And you come out of it saying that it comes down to doctors behaving differently in McAllen. You say, unless we figure out why this happens there and elsewhere, health care reform will fail. How do these doctors behave differently?
Well, it was a conclusion that I came very reluctantly to, and I approached it really with no idea what could explain why McAllen, Texas cost more, and traced it in a nutshell to this problem that it wasn't the health of the population. It wasn't amazing quality of care. I mean, the quality there was good. I met really terrific doctors, surgeons, great facilities. But in a nutshell, there is this battle between medicine, whether medicine is a business the way we practice it as doctors, or is it a profession? And, you know, in every community, and I hate really singling out McAllen on this, it happens to be the most expensive place in the country when you take into account the living costs. But there are lots of places with this kind of virus that goes through it. And it has to do with whether it's legitimate for you to focus in your practice on it as a business. That is, you increase the high margin stuff and you get rid of the low margin stuff. Well, what's the low margin stuff? It's taking phone calls from patients rather than make them see in your office because you're going to you can bill for the office visit, all the way up to whether you buy your way into imaging centers and surgical centers like I encountered in McAllen, hospitals that are physician-owned, so they get part of the profits from all the tests and surgery that are done there.
And a culture of money, one hospital administrator describes around medicine, around the practice of medicine in McAllen. We're going to look at that and how that plays out. Paint a picture of this town for us. This is way down the tip of Mexico. Lonesome Dove was set around here. McMurtry's a great cowboy story. It's a border town. Are there reasons on the face of it that residents of this town would need more expensive care, and do they get better care?
Well, one thing is it's a very poor town. There are a lot of uninsured, and one possibility is just that the costs of people who are very poor, they have more diabetes, more obesity, that this could be playing into it. But just up the border, and this is why I went to there rather than, say, Las Vegas or Miami or other. There are other high-cost places like this. Just up the border is El Paso, Texas, which has the similar story, very high rates of illegal immigrants, very high rates of poverty and diabetes and obesity. But they are at the national average of $7,500 per person per year on Medicare versus $15,000.
That is a gigantic difference, double. I mean, and if you multiply that out across the country, you say that's exactly the margin we cannot afford.
No, our country is in serious trouble. Because of health care, you know, as much as we are spending on the stimulus package or the wars, our deepest threat to our way of life is our health care costs going through the roof. It's bankrupting a million people a year. It's just knocked down our whole auto industry. It's going to be a huge problem for that future. And so when we and it's devouring our government. And so when we try to tackle this question of how do we cover people, it's also this huger question of can we find things that are beneficial that improve our care. And the striking thing out of McAllen going to El Paso or even going to places that are at the lowest cost areas of the country is they have higher quality but with lower costs.
It is possible. It's possible elsewhere. And you cite a bunch of those. President Obama just yesterday, again, apparently somebody on his staff's been reading this, Peter Orszag, who is the director of his Office of Management and Budget for the President, explicitly looking at your piece and saying, look, this is the poster child of McAllen. We've got to solve it there and solve it elsewhere. We'll look at how it gets done better. But some of these numbers out of McAllen are kind of incredible. Here, you said between 01 and 05 in this Texas town, Medicare patients critically ill received almost 50% more specialist visits in McAllen than in El Paso, just up the Texas border. They were two-thirds more likely to see 10 or more specialists in a six-month period. 05 and 06, the patients there received 20% more abdominal ultrasounds, 30% more bone density studies, 60% more stress tests, and right on at 200% more nerve conduction studies for carpal tunnel syndrome, 550% more urine flow studies to diagnose prostate troubles, and on and on and on without better outcomes. And you really are kind of suggesting, and you've got people down there saying, we'll hear from them in this hour, but you have doctors down there saying, you went out to dinner with some of them, and you've got a general surgeon saying, come on, you know, we all know that there is overutilization here, pure and simple, and by that he means what?
By that, he meant, as he put it to me, that it's gone from what does the doctor need to what does my business need. And that meant that it's not malpractice. Here, I talk about a study that—
There's nothing illegal about it.
That's right. You take somebody, for example, who has heartburn, and do they go home with an antacid and a basic test to make sure it's not a bacteria causing it? Or do you also have, for a first-time ordinary heartburn, have them get a gastroenterology specialist to see them, get an upper endoscopy with a scope going down and taking a look in their stomach? Well, the answer is in the high-cost parts of our country, and it's not just McAllen, they will predominantly get that kind of treatment, whereas in the lower-cost areas, they will get the simple treatment. And the findings are that the people are actually better off in the lower-cost areas. We do so many procedures, so much surgery and everything else in the high-cost areas that they actually have serious complications of it. We in our country are to the point where we're doing now more than 60 million operations a year on people. It's one for five, every five human beings, and we have 100,000 deaths per year, more than car accidents, from complications of surgery.
But you've got people in McAllen telling you this isn't just out of extra professional care for the health of patients. I mean, when the doctor says, let's give this patient the works, whatever that may mean for this particular treatment, there's something in it for the doctor here. You're quoting a doctor who we're going to talk to later who says medicine has become a pig trough here. What is in it for the doctor financially when they go ahead and just say, yeah, let's do dot, 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 right down the list, cost be damned?
Yeah. Well,
we don't know the business. A lot of us don't know how it works. What's in it for the
business
doctor?
Model, if you start looking at it that way, is that a surgical procedure makes you more money, so you do more operations in someone where it's on the fence. Someone described for me, for example, how doctors there would look at, and I've seen it elsewhere, would look at a gallbladder operation. A patient comes in with an attack from gallstones. In general, only 6 to 8% of those patients ever go on to need surgery. But he was finding there that if they had one attack, even though most will get better just with changing their diet and watching them for a bit, mm-hmm. That they would go on to surgery there because it's an extra $700 to $1,000. And it's insidious. It's one of those things where no one would explicitly say to themselves, not no one, but most people in there, even there, aren't saying to themselves, I'm just doing it for the money. And yet, they're also saying, look, I have to increase what's the high-margin stuff in my business and try to steer away from the low-margin stuff.
And it happens. It happens in McAllen again and again and again until it ends up without better health, but with double the national.
The stories were painful. Probably the one that really stuck in my mind was talking to a for-profit hospital executive who himself was sickened by what he found. He had worked up and down the border in Texas in many hospitals. And when he came to managing a hospital there in McAllen, he was approached by physicians who said to him, there are six hospitals in that area. Mm-hmm. I'll send my patients to your hospital, not if you give me the best possible quality of care, not if you improve the services here. They said, if you give me money, I'll send my patients here. And how much, I asked. And he said, the lowest asking was $100,000 a year, and the most was up to $500,000 a year.
Cash up front, and then I'll send the river of my patients to you, and then I'm clearly incented to send you all I can.
Right. And then the incentive clearly for the hospital is not to work on quality. It's to look at how you pay people off. Now, he was emphasizing to me, this was only a few physicians who came to him, but he had never in his career been asked to do this for one person. And what he'd found on the more subtle level was not the outright fraud. It was the tendency in situations where there could be revenue gain to have the revenue drive the decision rather than what was best for the patient.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what makes American healthcare so expensive through the story of one low-income community with some of the highest healthcare costs in the nation, McAllen, Texas. Dr. Atul Gawande is with us. He's written up the story for The New Yorker magazine in the June 1st issue, and it is really compelling. This is a community where people spend more than they make, where the healthcare costs are bested only by those in Miami. For any town in America, it is number one. And yet the outcomes are not, and the people there talk about a culture of money that has kind of, he doesn't use this word, but it almost has corrupted the delivery of health care. He says, we cannot succeed with health care reform unless we address this problem. Let's get a call right here. Kat in Boston, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. It's nice to be speaking with you both. I'm a pharmaceutical sales representative here in Boston, Massachusetts. And Dr. Gawande, I really want to applaud the efforts that you have made both in your novel Complications as well as in this latest New Yorker article, because I feel like most of the time the burden of the high cost of healthcare is blamed on pharma, and we are just a small part in a very large, messy situation here in the United States, and a lot of it does have to do with the reimbursements for doctors and you know, a small portion of that is the high cost of branded medication, but currently I do feel like there's more at play here, and I'm very, very glad that you're bringing these issues to the surface. I thought it was a great piece.
Pulling back the curtains, pharmaceutical industry has had lots of brickbats thrown at it. You're looking a bit wider here. Kat, thanks for your call. Still going on, we've got a lot of callers, and we're going to hear from a doctor from McAllen, but I wish you'd do a little more with a kind of comparison here of the evidence of the kind of culture of money around healthcare in this town versus some sort of counterexamples that are very effective. The hospital administration who called it that way told you that he knew of doctors who owned strip malls and orange groves and apartment complexes and imaging centers and surgery centers and parts of the very hospitals that they worked in, that it was, they had this kind of entrepreneurial approach to medicine. Why not? I, in a way, but that they were innovative and aggressive in finding ways to increase revenues from patient care. You hold that up against counterexamples like what?
Well, one of the things that struck me when I left McAllen was I came away thinking all of the incentives in healthcare are to go this way. You are rewarded for owning an imaging center, owning a surgery center. We're in a capitalist country.
Mm-hmm.
I came away with the puzzle not of why is McAllen different. I came away wondering, why isn't the rest of the country like McAllen? It's not doing this. And so I started exploring at the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. The places are getting spending very low amounts of money, less than $6,000 per year for
less healthcare. Than half what they spend.
Less than half what they spend, but getting high quality results. And one example of that is Mayo Clinic.
Mm-hmm. Rochester, Minnesota, famed for its care,
has amazing capacity, capabilities, technology. It is the kind of service that you would want, and yet they have a lower costs. And the answer there was partly when I talked to the CEO, I said, what is different there? Why is your volume so much lower and your results so great? And he said, one of the things they did, and they had to do it going back decades, is they had to blunt the financial incentives. They actually go so far as putting the doctors on salary there. But then they also have a collective capability to keep everybody together on track for patients, because medicine has become so complex that having one specialist here, one specialist there, but nothing tying them together, they made it easy. I'd visited there, and one of the things that struck me was going to an appointment with a surgeon who had to see a patient. They had a cardiology problem before their operation. They said, well, you know, let's get the cardiologist in on this, and the cardiologist literally walked right in. They changed the system to make it so the doctors had time to think about the patient, and they found it led to less testing, better use of technologies, and better results for the patient.
And they're not looking for churn. They're not looking to do more tests, and yet they cost half what you found in McAllen, and the results are some of the best in the nation.
That's right. One of the cheapest places in the country is a town called Grand Junction, Colorado, where when I explored how is it set up there, the doctors there didn't even know until recently they were the least expensive in the country. Mm-hmm. They were getting some of Medicare's highest quality ratings. And the answer that they had was that they weren't on salary, but they had pooled their income so that they blunted those folks who – they rewarded the people who saw the uninsured, for example. The second thing they did is they had peer review committees where the orthopedic surgeons would sit down with one another and say, are we doing too much back surgery? And they just did this out of a sense of professional responsibility that they would ask, are we doing anything that's over-treatment? Are we also under-treating people for prevention and the total amount of care there? They invested in ideas like electronic health records for the whole town. And they did it almost by happenstance. It was the culture of the medical community, but they succeeded. And we want to reward those communities that are doing it in such a successful way and avoid rewarding these others. It was medical culture that was different in those places and protected from that tendency to see it like it's just revenue.
And critical for the future of this country, you write, and many would agree. We're going to hear in just a moment from a doctor in the culture of McAllen, Texas, but maybe not of. Let's get a call here first from Waukee, Iowa, and David. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a brief anecdote about my mother-in-law who lived in the McAllen area until a couple of years ago when she moved up here to Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
She had a general practitioner down there who would call her about once a month to tell her to come in and get her blood pressure checked. And I don't know if she wanted to check anything else, but there was nothing wrong with her. I mean, she had a little bit of a history of high blood pressure, but she had it well under control. But about once a month, like clockwork, this doctor down there in McAllen would tell her to come in and get her blood pressure checked.
Did she have the sense that she was being milked a little bit, or her insurance company being milked, David? Did she ever put it that way?
Well, she was on Medicare, but I think she had a pretty good sense, that she was being milked, yes.
There's a first-hand report. Let's hear from a doctor in McAllen, Texas. We're joined right now from McAllen by Dr. Lester Dyke. He's a cardiac surgeon, has performed more than 8,000 heart surgeries in the past couple of decades, quoted at some length in Atul Gawande's article, being very critical of what's happening in his community, his county. Dr. Lester Dyke, thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay, let's go straight to it. You're quoted by Atul Gawande saying, medicine has become a pig trough here. Now, you're muttering that in his piece, and now it's in black and white. What does that mean?
Well, what's really happening is the legal, but, you know, very undesirable and even counterproductive funneling of taxpayer dollars into the hands of a group of people who are able to bill the government for their services essentially with no limit. And, it seems to me that it's overdue. The public who's paying these bills, that's you and me, the taxpayer. You know, the government doesn't generate revenue. It basically taxes us.
Sure.
And then pays other people. So, do we want, you know, we're the guys paying the bill. I think we have the right to demand some kind of reasonable limit or oversight to ensure that this money is being spent, you know, reasonably and wisely. And, you know, that really doesn't exist right now.
What's the culture? What's the frame of mind that leads to that kind of, I guess, milking of the system, Doctor?
Well, let me explain something maybe to the folks listening that are not in the medical profession. You know, the concept of a separation of powers, of sort of checks and balances to prevent abuse, you know, was used in the formation of our very country, and, and really up until now, it's also served us well in the medical field. In that, for instance, hospitals are just pure businesses. You know, no matter what they tell you, they're in it for the money. Period. And this is true whether it's a corporate hospital or a religious hospital or a so-called not-for-profit hospital or, importantly, a doctor-owned hospital. Where doctors, on the other hand, are supposed to be a counterbalance to this. They're supposed to care only for their patients' well-being. So if a hospital lives up to their expectations and does the right thing and takes good care of their patients, doesn't cut too many corners, they use it. If it doesn't, they are free to use another hospital for their patients. So, see, the doctors are, and they should always be, their patients' unalloyed advocates. And this is why Americans love and trust their doctors traditionally. You know, they've never had to worry about a conflict of interest like this before. So when doctors and hospitals, when doctors are the hospital owners or the owners of labs or CAT scanners or whatever, who speaks for the patient? If doing one thing is better for the patient but worse for the bottom line, who's there to ensure that the patient's well-being is served first and not second?
In other words, when they own the lab or a piece of the hospital, they've got a conflict of interest.
Right. I mean, we're only human. You know, temptation and divided loyalties are going to lead to a deterioration of professional priorities. And the Stark laws have tried and, I think, succeeded to preventing such abuses, some abuses to some extent, but there's huge gaps in them. And so what the end result, Tom, is an overwhelming array of, I kind of call it the medical industrial complex, kind of a comparing it to the old military industrial complex. But instead of, you know, business using the military for their profit rather than defending the country, we have a situation where we have a huge array of hungry business entities of different kinds using the patient for their profit primarily rather than profiting secondarily, taking care of the patient.
But Dr. Dyke, you live and work in this community and in this culture. Are you a real outlier there? I mean, are you longer welcome at the country club talking like that? There are a lot of people making their living and good livings off this practice of medicine.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I've gotten a lot of negative publicity, but, you know, that's okay. Really, what I would like, you know, your listeners to think about is, do you want your loved ones taken care of by a traditional doctor who only has his patient's interest at heart, or by an MD who behaves more like a businessman, you know, with profit as his prime motive? You know, do you want to rest secure that your doctor is sending you to a hospital or a lab or a CAT scanner because it's the best, or worry that it's because, you know, he's an investor in it? And also, do you want to know that your doctor is sending you to a specialist who's the best in his field, or worry that he's being consulted simply because he's your doctor's business partner? I mean, it's an unfortunate fact that, you know, today's patient has never had to worry about these things before, but now it's gotten to the point where they probably should question their physician about these things if they have any doubts about his advice.
Atul Gawande, you point out that there is a downside risk to the overprescription of procedures and so on, that every time you're sort of worked with by the healthcare industry, there's risk involved.
Yes. The difficulty is that there is a gray zone in medicine. There's a great deal of uncertainty where judgment is required. You come in with a chest pain. You come in with a heartburn. And you overtreat and overtest, and you're subject to risks that can outweigh the benefits. And we see this in surgery. You see it in testing. And our chance to limit that harm is turning out to be important to the whole quality and safety of American care in ways that allow us to face the possibility of controlling costs in healthcare without taking the first step to be simple rationing. And that's where policymakers see the opportunity. If it turns out that there is poor value for the money we're spending, then let's get the higher value and have better results as well as a less costly system.
But the conclusion you come to is that currently our healthcare industry is pushing in the other direction, away from Mayo Clinic, away from cost conservative healthcare, and toward the McAllen, Texas model.
Yes, there's a battle for the soul of American medicine that Dr. Dyke and others are in the middle of, and the incentives are to reward quantity over quality and to reward physicians acting as individuals rather than as part of teams that are responsible for the total health results of a patient. And there are ways to reward the communities that have been headed in the other direction, which has been towards more collaborative medicine and towards focus on quality above all else.
Dr. Dyke, in McAllen, why do you think you've ended up sort of at a nexus there of this profit-seeking kind of medicine? You've got only Miami has higher healthcare costs than you've got in McAllen. I mean, that's pretty incredible. That's $15,000 per capita through Medicare. Why in McAllen? Does it feed on itself somehow? Why do you have apparently more doctors there with this philosophy of medicine/business?
I think it was just sort of an unfortunate juxtaposition of a bunch of doctors that wanted to make more money and some pretty brilliant businessmen who kind of showed them how to set it all up. I think doctors are notoriously bad businessmen, which is probably a good thing in retrospect, but you know, these businessmen are very, very good at what they do, and they were able to construct a model whereby the majority of the primary care doctors in the town, I think, are now members of this big organization and essentially control the flow of patients. And you know, most of the doctors are in the community, I think, are ethical doctors, but there's just no question that there's a huge impetus once this organization comes about and is thriving to continue to generate income, and a lot of pressure is generated on these doctors to keep doing that. And unfortunately, instead of standing up and saying no, we're not going to do this or this isn't right, you know, a lot of them have sort of succumbed to temptation, and so you have this skyrocketing cost, which is, you know, pretty shameful. People have sort of been mad at me. They're saying that I'm helping some guy, you know, from Massachusetts, making us look bad. And I tell them, I said, frankly, it's us that's making ourselves look bad. And it took this, you know, brilliant young guy from Cambridge, Massachusetts, of all places, to pick up on this and to come down and expose it.
Come down and lift the lid, Atul Gawande.
Yeah.
Why do you think
Why
do you think this concentration is there?
Well, one of the interesting things, I talked to an economic sociologist, of all people, a guy named Woody Powell at Stanford, who's looked at the culture of different cities and why they are different. He looks at biotechnology. Mm-hmm. Why did Boston and San Francisco do better than L.A. and Philadelphia? And mm-hmm. what he found is they have what he calls anchor institutions, places that set the norms that are really institutional almost than individual people. And they had norms in those places of open sharing of information, collaboration, and I think it applies here. You saw in McAllen 15 years ago, they were actually in the norm. They were in the middle of American healthcare spending. The cost shot up about 4 or 5 years later with the arrival of new leaders in a couple of institutions in town that started to set new tone for what the goals were. And it shifted from a place where it was very much like El Paso, very middle of the road, to a place where there was entrepreneurial energy and leadership that was being successful for people in town. And for those who thought this was a bad way to go, they weren't able to change the institutional culture, whereas the institutional culture in places like Mayo and Grand Junction have held fast to the idea that above all, they are there for the needs of the patient, even when it conflicts with the revenues.
Dr. Dyke, we've just got half a minute left with you. Do you think healthcare reform out of Washington can set up some incentives that could change this kind of situation in McAllen and elsewhere?
I think there's probably as good a chance as there has been in the last 20 years with this new administration, and I would just ask our nation's leaders to keep our doctors looking out for us first, not themselves first, and remove the temptation to behave like a banker or a contractor, and you know, because when all is said and done, there are some things that are more important than money, and medical care is one of them.
Dr. Lester Dyke in McAllen, Texas, cardiac surgeon there. We appreciate your work and your candor today. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Dyke.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what makes American healthcare so expensive. One of the things, at least, through the story of one low-income community was some of the highest health care costs in the nation, McAllen, Texas. Dr. Atul Gawande went to McAllen for the New Yorker magazine, brought back a kind of incredible story that is making waves right across the country and in Washington, in the White House, where the director of the Office of Management and Budget, Peter Orszag, is writing about it, where Barack Obama appears to be talking about it in his meetings with legislators there. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York, and Will. Hi, Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Dr. Gawande. I think I have a story here that sort of exemplifies a couple of the major problems in American medicine. And I'm a medical student, and it's sort of an eye-opener my third year here to see what the actual practice of medicine is. What happened was there was I was working with a surgeon who was doing a colonoscopy, who was consulted to do a colonoscopy in the patient, and the person who was doing the surgeon really didn't really believe that this was warranted. This patient was a terminally ill, demented patient, who the results of the colonoscopy were not really going to change the management. But we still went ahead and did it. And when I asked him, "Why are you doing it if you don't think it's medically or even ethically right to do it?" He says, "Because if I refuse to do it, I won't be consulted by that doctor and his group anymore, because I will be questioning their judgment."
In other words, he wouldn't get the business from them anymore.
Exactly. Which it sort of shows, one, it raises the issue of the care for the terminally ill, which we all know is a big issue in this country, and this web of consults where everybody is afraid to refuse a consult because then they'll lose the business from that person. So they just go ahead and do the unnecessary consults regardless of what.
Right. And so will we get a colonoscopy ordered up for a terminally ill patient? Thanks for that. Let me hold that for just a minute and get one more right here from Anne in Boston. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Dr. Gawande, it's a pleasure to hear you speak. I've read a couple of your books. I'm calling kind of from a couple of different points of view. I'm a lawyer. I'm a student of ethics, and I have a chronic illness.
Okay.
And my big issue is I can't get past this not being malpractice. I can't get past the Hippocratic Oath not speaking to this directly. And you'd said specifically, this isn't malpractice per se, and I really need an explanation on that. I don't understand.
And we'll go straight to it. Thank you for your call, Atul Gawande.
Well, I mean, can you sue somebody who checks your blood pressure once a month for checking your blood pressure once a month? No. But there was a really interesting study where they looked at high-cost and low-cost communities and found that the most common for a person with ordinary blood pressure, in the most common way it would be ordered in lower-cost parts of the country, is you check the blood pressure once every 6 months, and they got no worse care for it. But in places that were high-cost, you have a check every 1 to 3 months. And the troubles here.
It's not illegal. It's not malpractice.
That's right.
But yet Anne is trying to look more deeply at the Hippocratic Oath and saying, "Well, really, really, if you're pushing it toward a profit rather than, the perfect mean."
That's right. And so you start to say, "Well, the solution here then is let's do what they did in Mayo. Just put everybody on a salary." The trouble is that if you don't have a culture in the medical community and institutions that reinforce the culture that says this isn't about the money, then you can put everybody on salary and everybody go home at noon and say, "Well, I got my salary. I'm not seeing any patients at all." You could go from overtreatment to undertreatment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The communities that are making it work, the Grand Junction, Colorado, as I mentioned, Geisinger Clinic in Pennsylvania,
and
other
places.
And
you talk about in Salt Lake City. And
Intermountain Healthcare.
Right,
in Salt Lake City.
Marshfield, Wisconsin. Marshfield and Northern California, Kaiser Permanente, you hold in that category.
That's right. And people know systems don't say everything is perfect, but those places are producing higher quality with lower costs. And the way they're doing is they are having the physicians actually sit down and collaborate. So, you know, Josh, who had the surgeon who talked about the referral that wouldn't come to him, they would sit down and say, well, are we in a situation where we're over-treating people? How are we doing with people at the end of life? Are mm-hmm. we putting way too many in the ICUs? Mm-hmm. Are we doing the appropriate balance between hospice care and other and aggressive care? And, you know, there aren't straightforward answers here. If there were straight answers, you'd just say, well, every time you have this kind of patient, you do it this way. You need people using their judgment. And the way we create it is by creating local medical communities that are successful at it, rewarding the ones that are doing it successfully. One way that's been approached is to call those communities that are bringing their doctors together, blunting some of the financial incentives, but focusing on overtreatment and undertreatment, reward them by saying, look, if you lower your costs and you meet quality goals, mm-hmm. we'll let you keep half the savings you generate. There are other approaches that say, look, we will protect your we will make it easier for you to get information technology, you know, that big $19 billion sure. stimulus package. Mm-hmm. Make it so that, that the communities that band together to work on these problems get that technology first, because they'll use the technology for the best outcomes.
So look at different incentives and maybe do it in the context of healthcare reform. We've got on the website questions about malpractice from the other side and on the telephone as well. Here's Chris in Nampa, Idaho. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. There seems to be another flip side to this argument, which is that in places like McAllen, it would be interesting to know what the ratio of malpractice lawsuits were. You discussed over-treatment, and I know that just a few moments ago there was an attorney that called that wanted to suggest that maybe this practice of overcharging and over-treating was actually malpractice. I think that malpractice may actually be driving some of this over-treatment, where medical professionals have such a desire to have to cover themselves against these unnecessary malpractice lawsuits that they have to run every imaginable unnecessary test for every patient, because it's the only way to protect themselves if that case should end up in a courtroom.
Yeah, it's a good question, Chris. Atil Gawande, what did you find in McAllen on that front? Malpractice fear, and so order up everything.
And people there definitely talked about the idea that McAllen, you know, people, some of them call it a judicial hellhole, and they pointed to malpractice being a consideration. One of the things that happened, though, was that about 5 years ago in Texas, they passed a law capping malpractice punitive damage awards at $250,000. And so I asked the surgeons and the doctors, and I said, well, did that malpractice law not make a difference? I said, oh, yes, it did. Their lawsuits dropped tremendously. Their malpractice mm-hmm. premiums were way down. And they said, well, so then what's going on? They said, well, sometimes the habits can linger. What I did is I worked with Dartmouth University researchers to look at the data from Medicare. And one of the things that was striking was that, yes, there is over-ordering of scans, and that can be because of trying to avoid malpractice. But there was also over-ordering of things that wouldn't have to do with malpractice. So, for example, doing more surgical procedures for things that like back surgery and so mm-hmm. on. Then also you saw things like they have 500% more home nursing visits ordered. And that's not something that you do out of concern for malpractice.
But every time they order home nursing, they'll get a piece of that?
And that was the striking thing, talking to the home nursing agencies and how they did things. There is a culture that had built up that rewards the doctors for ordering the test, whether it's sets of – I talked to a home nursing agent who mm-hmm. Finds that she has to give sets of jewelry. She had a colleague asked to buy a red Mercedes for a physician to order the home nursing visits.
So that they would get the business when it's ordered up.
That's right. And there are 260 home health nurse agencies there, and very many of them have now gotten a medical salary, a salary for what they call a medical director, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of reward for those who can bring them the most business.
Complicated picture, but what we end up with, a huge, huge cost. Let's go to Albany, New York, and Lindsay. Lindsay, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. What do you know, Lindsay?
I used to work about 40 miles west of McAllen, and my experience with the healthcare system there was my primary care doctor was telling me I had to come in to have a titer read, into the office, pay the copay, be billed. I asked him why that was. I said I had received multiple results in New York by phone. He said the insurance company made him do that. I called my insurance company, asked them why that was. That wasn't the case. And I went back to my doctor and asked him why he told me that. He became very...
Lindsay's breaking up on us there, but
she got the story.
We got the story. I see a little bit more that we heard from her before we got her on air. She also said she worked with AmeriCorps in that region near McAllen and teaching, and saw a lot of people who didn't have great education levels and were very dependent on the doctor. Just do whatever the doctor says. Is there a cultural issue here?
It can, but you know, in medicine, there are very informed consumers patients who come to you, and you have real discussions about the risks and benefits. But no matter where you are, the majority of patients will tend to go with your recommendations, and that's why the focus on whether it's a public insurer, a government insurer, or an insurance company that's driving the financing of the system misses, I think, the key point here, which is that the dollars are spent by the decisions that people make in their offices with their doctors. And in that moment of time, there are different ways a doctor can think about what they're doing when it comes to the money side. They can ignore the money and just say, look, as long as my bills come out okay at the end of the month, I can pay my secretary, I get my malpractice premium paid for, and I'm taking home enough, I don't care. And I think that's the way most physicians practice, kind of oblivious to it. The second one is that there are people who think of the money as a means to make the service actually better. They look at the money and they say, okay, I've got enough money. I'm going to spend some of it on easier phone and email access, even though insurance companies don't pay for it. They'd hire a nurse to monitor their diabetic patients and make sure women got their mammograms on time. That's the group that focus on making the quality better, and they produce the lowest costs in the system. And then there are the ones who see the practice as a revenue stream, and you start to see that kind of subtle practice. You know, the reality is that if he gave the results over the phone, he would get no pay for it, but it takes time. And I face this every day. I have to...
As a doctor,
it is not easy all the time to make the ends meet. And the incentives are perverse. Email and phone can take time. No one's paying you for it. And when you're tired and it's at the end of a 15-hour day, it's very easy to say, you know, damn it, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, just make them come in and let's get the copay here. But it's your professionalism. It's the ethics and it's the culture of your colleagues around you that hold you back and have you doing the right thing.
But I want to ask about exactly that cultural expectations here in the medical profession, because I think for many years in this country, there was the image people had that drew many into medical school, service to and helping people, yes, but also doctors were affluent people in the community. They may live in country club place. They'd drive the nice car to be a doctor. It was assumed that came along with a kind of a place, you know, somewhere up in the top of the economic pyramid in this country. Can we have healthcare reform and still have that be the case? What does it mean if we don't? Is your message essentially to doctors, you're going to become salaried workers and not necessarily very highly paid salary workers if we want healthcare reform to work out for this country? Is that what's embedded in your critique?
Well, And the reason I don't think so is when you look at the places at the bottom of the scale, their physicians are very well compensated. Mayo doctors or ones in Grand Junction, Colorado, or the ones in Intermountain Healthcare, they do very well.
I've heard doctors complain who were in HMO saying, I've got to get out of this. Everything is capped. All I've got is a salary. I expected a certain lifestyle if I got into this business. If I don't get a private practice and kind of get entrepreneurial, I'm never going to achieve and this is not everybody, but I've heard doctors say this, what I came here for.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there in that model of the world, there won't be the doctors who make millions like I found some in McAllen. And so that's extreme end of the picture. Just it's not going to be there and it can't be there.
Is that a problem for medicine or is that exactly what we should be working for to get rid of that sort of cream?
Yeah. No, that's got to go. And it's just not going to be part of medicine. But in those other communities, you know, physicians still are very well paid in our society, and people are supportive of having physicians be well paid. In In some salaried situations, people will walk out of it, leave that because they can be lower salary. And I don't know that salarying everybody is the solution. But I'll tell you what we're seeing in this current economic crunch. There was a time 10 years ago when I had lots of my colleagues saying to me, I can't believe a guy I went to school with is this Wall Street hotshot now pulling in tens of millions of dollars, and what am I doing in this job?
These are doctors looking over at investment bankers, whatever. Mm-hmm.
And now those guys are out in the street, and
the bankers,
bankers, and the physicians are saying to themselves, you know, I'm glad I've had a steady, stable position. And there was just an article that was in the Washington Post, and also it's been a lot in the medical press about physicians actually deciding to go for the jobs where they have a more secure salary, because in medicine, where you are dependent on a lot of people paying cash up front in the business, people are losing those patients because they can't afford it. As I said, a million people a year going bankrupt because they couldn't afford the medical care. And that was before the crash.
We've just got a minute left. Can we build this change in incentives into health care reform? Do you see it coming? Does it have to be in there to achieve what President Obama and others have said we need?
Yes. Yes. I think we can do it, and I think it has to be in there. And what it is not going to produce savings in 4 years. The ability to provide incentives that make the culture of medicine, make it easier for people in those communities that are doing well to have a culture of medicine that focuses on needs of patients and quality, will reduce costs, but it won't be tomorrow. It's a 10-year, 15-year experiment. But this shouldn't have been the first article that looked at the two extremes. Within our country, we have the solutions, and they lie in a third of our cities that are doing it at half the cost of what we do elsewhere.
Well, it was a pretty tremendous piece of reporting from a surgeon on the side, and we're very grateful for it. The Cost Conundrum was the piece in the June 1st issue of the New Yorker magazine. Atul Gawande, thank you for your time today, and thanks for this work. Just terrific out of McAllen, Texas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.